Oh, you okay?
Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on Kaechung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. I'm Nicholas Miller, and I'm here, as always, as ever, with Stephen Cato.
Hey, it's me, Steve Cato, and tonight, as every night since Too True went off the air, we are the longest-running show on Kaechung Radio. But you know, maybe it's because we've reached the top of the mountain, but I'm not, that's not fulfilling to me the way it used to be, you know? I feel like being the longest running isn't enough for me now. I want to be something else, right?
That's right, Steve. That's right. Yeah, it's a funny accolade. Yeah. Longest running micro broadcasting for the arts, talking, blah blah blah. It's kind of like when you watch, you know, professional sports.
I rarely.
And they say things like, "Oh my goodness, this is the first time that a team on February 8th with a headwind scored a goal in the first minute of the third quarter."
And some guy knows this.
Okay.
Yeah, right. This is some guy's whole job.
Some bad behavior begun by the same logic that begat the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah, but just in sports, it's infinite, right?
Smallest man to consume longest hot dog.
Oh, God, that would be so funny, though. That would be really good. What a good record. Think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's something of the idea of legacy in there.
Yeah.
To do something no one else has done, pass that along. Which,
yeah. Have your kids
I
know.
I should say, in classic talking show segue style, it's part of the theme of the talking tonight.
Okay.
This has been
Here it comes.
Years in the making. Many a email. Between us and our guest tonight's booking agent,
CCA.
He is not an easy man to get a hold of.
No.
Nor should he be. Talented actors in this town, their time gets gobbled up like Thanksgiving turkey.
Oh, wow.
So let's get right to it because he's got a lot to say tonight. The one, the only, Michael Douglas.
I was born in 1944. Blessed with the fact that my mother is an actress and my father met in acting school together. So I guess it would be ultimate that I would get into this business and this craft out of the joy that they had. And soon after they got married, my father moved out to Hollywood. And the pressures of careers and celebrity and being able to pick all the peaches from the trees, I think were a little tough for them and for anyone. They got divorced very soon, and I moved back and lived in New York City, grew up there. And then would progressively go back and see my father in California over the years. And I think the biggest advantage of being second generation is seeing these people, as you said, your father with his best friends, be it Burt Lancaster or Frank Sinatra, as people, seeing their foibles, seeing their vulnerabilities, and not just the illusion on screen. So I think it makes it a lot easier for yourself and how you conduct yourself in your own life later on. But they had a great camaraderie that existed in Hollywood in the 50s. Which really isn't there anymore, because movies now are made around the world. The studio system has changed technically and everything else. They use less sound stages. So people live and work all over the world and don't have the kind of camaraderie and close-knit feelings that existed then. My father, in his, you know, his autobiography, The Ragman's Son, is a rags-to-riches story. His father was a junk man. He worked his way through. And he too has a great, you know, stamina and discipline. And I think that's ultimately what gives you a career. I mean, talent, pure talent can give you a moment, but it's the discipline and stamina that give you a career. And the ability to make choices passionately and emotionally, but also objectively. And I think I learned a lot of that from my father, who's a very, very competent producer as well. Besides Spartacus, his company, Bright Eye Productions, did a number of films. And you learn, and certainly I did at a very early point, about story and three-act structures and what your responsibility is to the piece. I mean, I didn't know what else to do when I was, you know, in the university. I was a hippie. It was 1963. I was at the University of California in Santa Barbara. It was a great, exciting time. The music scene was exploding in San Francisco. I was having a fabulous time. And it was my third year in the university, and they called me into the office and said, you know, you've got to declare a major. You can't just be taking these general education courses. You're a third year in the university now. I said, okay, man, guess I'll take theater, man, you know. And my mother was an actress and spent a lot of time growing up with her, and she did theater in New York, and of course, my father. And yeah, I had terrible stage fright for a long time, you know, puking wastebaskets before you'd go on. And I don't know why, I just figured just try to something to overcome, really. And struggled with it for a long time, and was actually just blessed when I finally got the Streets of San Francisco television series, not only blessed because of Carl Malden, who's an extraordinary man, but also because I did 104 hours. You know, 104 hours, and I knew there was no hook to pull you off, that I was there, and it was only through that rote, you know, constantly being in front of these, you know, these lenses. And in those days, the cameras were huge, you know, sort of looked like that X-ray machine in your dentist's office, you know. And it just finally just kind of got worn down and gained confidence at the same time.
Actors, what a job. You know, I used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, rush through my breakfast, jump in my car, race down to the studio, get into wardrobe, makeup, get up on that stage, and then at 9 o'clock in the morning, you invent the telephone, win the West, sway juries, make love to the most beautiful women in the world, hour after hour after hour. I thought I had it made. Then, zoom. I was a star.
I used to like to race. I was a teenager. I was into hot rods. We were in a hot rod club. I had a dragster we used to race, and later on I used to race Formula F cars. And so I was a pretty good driver. But the first day of work, I'll never forget with Carl, I was so nervous. I'm looking at this guy, and Carl, those piercing blue eyes, look at you. And it was the first day of work, and we're in San Francisco, and the light's going. I said, all right, hurry up, we gotta get one shot. You guys just come out here, go past the Fairmont Hotel, then down the hill. And you know, Carl, this thing, we'd stick the gumball, the flashing light up on the roof. So I said, let's go. And I took off, went around the corner, and I went off the hill, and all I know is I had enough time to look over at Carl in midair, him look at me in midair, right off the hill before this screech into a halt, you know, that nobody got killed, the wheels were straight. I thought I was out of a job. First day, I think I'm out of a job. He said, that's not driving, that's not driving, because that's theater driving. And he was so angry at me, and then he, only in the way he could, all right, I'm going back to my trailer and change my underwear. So he said, and he was, you know, he was great. He trusted me after that.
Well, he sure went to town last night.
Carl Malden is my mentor. You know, he really, I've certainly learned a tremendous amount from watching my father over the years. But as far as someone who really took me under his wing, somebody who loves teaching, you know, Carl Malden was it for me. And he too, coincidentally, had been in summer stock, summer theater, with my father when they first were beginning their careers. And my father's name was Isidor Danielovich, and Carl's name was Mladen Sokolovich. And they got together one summer and said, maybe we should change our names. And so, as a result, Kirk and Carl. And Carl, you know, Carl's a Serb, came from Gary, Indiana, the steel mills, had a deep appreciation of how fortunate he was to be in this business, you know, knew what real jobs were like, had a tremendous work ethic. And so we would shoot a 52-minute, it's an hour show, but 8 minutes for commercials, a 52-minute film in 7 shooting days. And because we were on location in San Francisco, we would shoot 6-day weeks. And you did 26 episodes, so you went for 8.5 months straight shooting a show in 7 shooting days, one right after another. And Carl said, the only way I can do this is when I start 1 week's script, I want to have the next week's script already there. And so we would be shooting, and then in between shots, when they were relighting and everything, Carl would grab me and we would go into a room and we were rehearsing the next week's script, memorizing the lines, because in those TV cop shows, the regulars got to kind of carry the plot line and all of that. And so, you know, it's just like lifting weights. And sitting in there with Carl and working on next week's script and seeing what the problems were in the scripts or this or that, or how to improve them, how to change them, seeing what your responsibility was. And yes, when you had those long exposition scenes that were not particularly well written, you had to talk fast. That's always the best direction to give anybody, you know, usually is talk fast. And then there are times to take your time. But the writers hated us because of how hard we worked and how much we rehearsed. The scripts had to be at least 6-7 pages longer than most TV scripts, simply because we were picking up our cues, you know, and going. So Carl, you know, taught me a lot about structure. Carl taught me about what my responsibility is to the script, even if it's starring you. You know, what is my responsibility to the script? Where do I bring humor in if it's required? Where do I bring threat? Where do I pick up the pace? And this is how I think when it came time for me to leave the show, and I left early to produce One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I didn't realize just how much I had learned. And Carl, as we speak now, is 93, still alive, a great man, and I owe him a lot. And I hope every young actor is fortunate enough to have a mentor.
You see, I've been where I'm going. The way I play now, just percentages. Don't win much, don't lose much.
Do you think you were ready when you sat down with him?
I thought I was the best stud poker player in the world. I'm telling you, I thought I was the best.
I got something, Shooter. You know I've got something.
Yeah, you've got something. I know that, kid.
Now, Como, I think, was my first movie as an actor, you know, maybe after Streets of San Francisco. And what happens in television is you pick up some sloppy habits sometimes of, because the writing isn't so good, of kind of making it your own. You add handles and this and that. You know, myself and Jean-Vive Bougeot were playing live-in lovers who are also interns in a hospital. Michael Crichton, who was the director, and also a very good writer on himself, and was an MD, was a doctor in another life. And the opening of Coma, I think it was almost over titles, over credits, is Jean-Vive and I coming back to the apartment and talking, how was your day, what happened, and this and that. And I had a long, you know, 4-page monologue, which involved a lot of medical terms and expressions. So anyway, I thought I had it memorized pretty good, and I went and started doing it and, you know, and talking about these medical terms, the melanoma, the carcinosis, this. And Mike said, no, it's the melanoma, the carcinosis. All right, so now, I took off. You know, I couldn't remember my name. And I think it was actually 63 takes I did. It was one of the most painful lessons that I ever had in my life about, you know, about learning your lines, like really learning your lines. And it went on and on and on. It was a nightmare day that I'll never forget.
Have a beer, you'll feel better.
You know what would make me feel better? You goddamn doctors. Couldn't I fall in love with a nurse? Dorothy on the 8th floor, yeah. She liked me. My own apartment. Well, the history of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a little... My father bought the novel in galley form before it was published and went to Broadway in 1960 and did the play for 6 months in Broadway. It was not successful, maybe a little ahead of its time. And that's a process a lot of people do, even today, where they take a piece of material to the theater and then eventually make it to a film. And so he did it, and then he tried for about 4 or 5 years afterwards to try to make, you know, get the film going, and he couldn't get the film going. Meanwhile, I'm at the university. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the novel, has been out, and it's become a required reading in 20th century American lit courses. Now, 5 years later, the off-Broadway version of the play has come out and is a success. Meanwhile, I've started my acting career. It's going okay, and I know my father's trying to sell the rights now. He's selling the rights to Cuckoo's Nest. And so I said, well, look, let me see if I can set it up and get it going. And I did. And, you know, one of the only provisos, and to this day, Kirk won't let me forget, was he didn't get to play the part. The fact that he had gotten a lot older, that his career was in a different place, didn't matter. The fact is he was a silent producing partner. The fact that he made more money off of Cuckoo's Nest than any movie's ever made didn't matter. My son didn't, you know. And so he's on for that. I think he would say it too, the only benefit, and I understand because there's not that many good parts out there, you know. You have a good role and a good piece, you know, you want it. But the saving grace is how good Jack was. He won the Oscar for Best Actor, and how good the movie was. It won Best Picture. So at least we didn't, you know, destroy it. We actually shot in the state mental hospital that Ken Kesey used in the book. And part of the process, it was a state hospital, and the head of the hospital was taking quite a risk letting us in there. And what he did, Dr. Dean Brooks, is he looked at the script and he analyzed a profile of what some of the other characters in the film, what their problems might be. And he kind of created a portfolio. Then these actors, before we started during the rehearsal period, would go up on the ward, would not tell the other patients that they were an actor, but would just be involved with them as a patient, would take part in the group therapy sessions with them, and they would kind of follow their Bible as to, you know, what was going on. And they were really, really good. And what happened was that Jack Nicholson could not make the early rehearsal period because of a previous commitment. And so when he showed up at work, and all of these actors were unknown, you know, pretty much all unknown, everybody was in such character, they never left it. So I remember the first day, he kind of was looking around, and, you know, we came to lunchtime, we had some lunch, he was looking around, and he took his tray, and he pushed it away, he went outside. I was a producer. I ran. I was the first day with Jack Nicholson. I said, "What, Jack? You all right?" He says, "Who are these guys? What's going on?" He said, "I can't. Nobody stops here. I mean, it's lunchtime. Can we stop? Have a lunch break? These guys are going all the time." And that's the kind of environment which sometimes you have to need for those kind of pictures, a closed environment, which would have been much more cost efficient to shoot at a studio in London or L.A., but made all the difference being there on location. Miloš Forman, I had seen a Czech movie called The Fireman's Ball. And The Fireman's Ball was about a small town in the Czech Republic that chose a queen of the holiday season in this little town. And it dealt with these multiple characters. And it had a wonderful vulnerability and kind of the foibles and the fumble and the klutziness of these characters, but yet done with a great sense of humor. And I thought with Cuckoo's Nest, you know, if we didn't get the humor in this piece, you know, and have some fun, it was going to be a long, dark, you know, dark evening. So many directors held their cards so close. They wouldn't tell us really what they wanted to do. We loved this project so much, but they all kind of held their cards so close to their chest. And Miloš came in and, you know, he opened the script to page one and he just took us through it from every page of how he would see it. And he did. He was the kind of guy, he had a vision. He had his own demons that he struggled with in terms of his confidence, this and that. But, you know, he was such a articulate man who had a clear vision of the whole piece. And again, it's one of the biggest lessons that I have learned, you know, from being a producer and also as an actor, is not to be afraid to ask your director, you know, what's going on. Because there's a lot of BS out there. There's a lot of times people haven't really clearly thought out how they're going to do it. And so simply asking them the question, you become like a sounding board. And you help, you know, help directors sometimes get a clearer picture, or you know what you're dealing with.
What did you think of it?
The scene?
Mm-hmm. Terribly original. Terribly or terribly, terribly?
Terribly, terribly.
My father's, it'll be 90 in December, and he's done 90 movies. In those days, he would easily do 4, maybe 5 movies a year. You have to remember there was only maybe 2 television stations that existed in black and white. They were near the outlets. So more people went to the films, but he was a workaholic.
Look, kid, you gotta choose between being tough or being dead.
He was working all the time, so on summer holidays, I would visit him. And that summer, I was 16, I worked in the film editor, as an assistant film editor. It was at Universal. And in those days, there wasn't a commissary, and so he'd be working in the editing room. We had our little paper lunch bags. And our favorite thing to do at that time was they were also doing the editing on Psycho. So we used to take our lunch bags at lunchtime and go down to the Psycho editing room and look at the outtakes of Janet Leigh in the shower. And that was pretty exciting for a 16-year-old, let me tell you. Well, I've been able to watch my father work for such a long time. But he has a great work ethic. We were talking before, he has a great sense of stamina. And he's done his homework. And one of the things that I think is he's really grown as an actor with his ability to listen. Because good actors, it's not so much when they're talking, it's when they're listening that you really kind of get a sense of a completion. And I think that was a good aspect I saw with him. Well, I remember about The Bad and the Beautiful, and I mean, Steven Spielberg is a great film buff historian. He sees everything. He's got a voracious appetite. And if he says it's one of the best movies about Hollywood, I'll believe.
Fred, I'd rather hurt you now than kill you off forever. You're just not ready to direct a million-dollar picture.
But you're ready to produce a million-dollar picture.
With Von Elstein? I am.
You're stealing my picture. It was my idea. I gave it to you.
Without me, it would have stayed an idea.
All right, Jonathan. Let's put it this way. You gave me a word.
So I did.
Good.
Jonathan, just got the starting date from the front office. 2 weeks from Monday, you leave for Veracruz. Mr. Von Elstein, I'll get you a reservation a week early.
Right. Mr. Shields, I'll tell you secrets. I don't like producers. But for a man who hands me such a script, eh? For him, it'll be a pleasure to break my iron rule. Today, I shall buy a producer lunch, Mr. Shields. Eh?
Am I included?
By all means, no, Mr. Shields. Today, I've seen what I thought I would never see. A script prepared by a producer who thinks like a director. For 13 years, I've been making pictures.
Goodbye, Jonathan. Fred, come on, Fred.
And this is the first time I've found a script I can present the track as it is. Shut my mouth.
I always said the boy was a genius.
All I know is I was, I think it's 1952, so I was probably 9 or 10. I went to visit the set the day that my father was having a romance scene with Lana Turner. And I walked into the set, it was all dark, and he had her here, he kissed, and he looked up at me, and I remember looking at my father, my, what's going on here, oh my God. And he just looked at me, he said, because I was in his sight line, he said, Michael. So yeah, I moved away, but I just remembered, the intensity of the two of them, and struck a strong chord that day.
Blue's my lucky.
Lust for Life was the, you know, the story of Vincent van Gogh, the artist, and it was directed by Vincent Minnelli, who's Liza Minnelli's father, and they did a lot of detailed research, you know, on the picture, and I think, you know, out of that film he learned a lot about the Impressionist period, because they went back and shot the exact locations where van Gogh had painted some of his most famous paintings. And I think it all helped to immerse my father completely in a role, and the similarity of how they looked was quite extraordinary.
She's just saying that apparently the first time she saw me come in here, she had quite a shock. She thought I looked very much like Van Gogh, but apparently she felt that Van Gogh was a little thinner than I.
And I do know that when my brother Joel and I saw the movie, I think Joel was 10, I was 12, and we went to see the movie. It was one of the only movies we've seen of our father. We kind of forgot it was our father. And when he came and he cuts his ear off in the movie, and he cut his ear off and the blood spews across the mirror, Joel took one look and started screaming, and he ran out of the theater. And he was also nominated. My father was nominated for an Oscar. And that picture, I think he should have won. With all due respect, I think it was Yul Brynner who won that year for The King and I, which was a good job. But it was a great performance by Dad. I think whenever you have successful parents, mothers or fathers, You tend to be a late bloomer. It takes you longer to kind of find out what you want to be. And particularly if your father is an actor and, you know, Spartacus leading the slaves, come on, follow me, and larger than life or being crucified. As a young kid, you kind of go, wow, will I ever be, forget it, being an actor, for, can I ever be the man that, you know, your father is? And then, you know, as you get a little older and this and that, you separate the illusion, which is on screen, versus the reality and the struggles that people deal with, the pressures that go on all the time. And I think, you know, if you both are actors, and the first thing that people say is, boy, you remind me so much of your dad. Well, if you're trying to establish your own identity, that's a little intimidating, you know, because, yeah, half your genes, 50% of your genes are your father's, but people know my mother, so you look like your mother. So it takes you a lot longer to, I think, kind of establish, you know, your own kind of identity. But as far as you know, stepping out of the shadow, no, I think for me it came at an earlier point, probably as, you know, as an actor. It was the year of Fatal Attraction and Wall Street, kind of back to back, which, you know, kind of one I got the Oscar for, and the other was very commercially successful, and that kind of stepped out. I mean, that said, you know, a lot of actors were under studio contracts in those days. On one hand, it guaranteed you a living, you know. On the other hand, it limited the kind of parts that you got a chance to play. My father, who was one of the few who fought the studio system and never really went under contract, but he took a big chance on, I think it was his sixth or seventh movie, which was Champion. It's produced by Stanley Kramer. And in that picture, which he was nominated for his first Oscar, he took a chance and played against the kind of sensitive young man roles that he first started playing in, and, you know, ironically, which is the first kind of roles that I did too. Well, I choose a movie first. I don't think I choose a role. I choose a movie. I look at scripts, and if I'm emotionally moved, you know, if it scares me, it's hot, it's romantic, it's funny, you know, it moved me. I got an emotional movement from reading a script. Then from all of those years on Streets of San Francisco, I kind of analyze a script. I kind of can close my eyes and I can kind of picture it structurally. And I see if it dramatically or comedically, the whole piece makes sense. If I didn't get seduced just by the written word, and I think now is there a whole structure, you know, to it. And then I look at my part. Then I really look, you know, at my part and say, well, have I done this before? Is this something different? I'm attracted to morally ambivalent characters, because that's how life is, I think, sometimes. I don't see a lot of saints walking around, nor do I see pure sinners walking around. It's about making choices in life. Sometimes people make the wrong choices, sometimes they make the right choices. And I think my responsibility of having a certain amount of success in this industry and not having to worry about where your next job is coming from is to test yourself. And so I try to make the best movie possible. I'm not worried about audience support. I do like to dig a big hole for my characters and have people know, oh, how is he gonna get out of this? And then try to maintain some reality and credibility of how you dig your way out of a hole. If I can find a piece that has some social redeeming value, so much the better. Doesn't come around that often, because you can't, at least up until An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's, which is more of a documentary, but unless it's a documentary, you cannot make something just for the sake of a social issue. It's always great if it happens. And then again, from my experiences, I try to surround myself with the best actors possible. I'm not threatened if there are a lot better actors than I am, and the best directors, because the only thing that matters is a good movie. It's the only thing that matters, not how good you were in a picture. So, and then I try to make everybody as good as they can be, you know, and try to, if I'm the star, like a lot of pictures I do, I'm in every single scene, so I'm there every day and new actors are coming in, you try to encourage them to just to be as comfortable as they can in this uncomfortable environment, lights, microphones, cameras.
Trouble, Ma.
What, Uncle Mike?
You got it.
Well, is he gonna help us?
I don't believe he's in a position to.
Harry, you told me he promised.
That I did.
Oh, can I see him for myself?
Yeah. He's on the mantle in the bedroom.
Danny DeVito is my oldest friends. We met when I was working at a summer theater when I was still in the university, and I used to work at this summer theater. It was called the National Playwrights Conference, which used to do new plays, and we were part of the acting repertory company that would present these new plays. Well, it just again turned about to be a golden, magical time. There's some great American playwrights like John Guare, Israel Horowitz, Sam Shepard, Lanford Wilson. We were doing these plays, and Danny DeVito was at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and he came up. And Danny is a great comedian. We obviously did the Romancing the Stone together, which I produced, and he was a tremendous asset in making that picture work, and then The Jewel of the Nile. And then Kathleen Turner and I went with Danny, which he directed, The War of the Roses. And The War of the Roses was a pretty dark comedy. And he has a great, dark, wicked sense, and I try to follow his advice about playing it straight, but there's the other part of me which just, you know, loves to camp it up, you know, so it's fun. You know, when you work with friends or you work with people that you worked with before, you don't have to go through this introductory dance. You're comfortable with each other. You know each other's rhythms, you know, tempos. Like working with Kathleen Turner for three pictures, you get a chance of you know, you can take chances, you know, not worrying if you're offending your actor or this or that. So it just makes it so much easier. I mean, Hepburn and Tracy, you understand, besides whatever else is going on, you know, why they're doing it so much. Jack, I'd love to, just because he's a wonderful actor. I mean, one of the great qualities that he has, and I think I particularly like, was we were talking about stage fright and camera shy, is that he almost uses the camera as an excuse to open up. He almost uses this environment to be more open in front of a camera than you might be in real life. And it's very effective, and hopefully we'll work together sometime. Well, the Oscars is presented by the Motion Picture Academy. And I don't know if everybody knows, what happens is there's the divisions of the Academy: film editors, art directors, production design, you know, there's individual divisions. And those divisions nominate, you know, the five nominees in their category. The Academy does not vote on the nominees for film editor. The Academy does not, only the acting branch votes for who the nominees are, right? So it's a tremendous honor that your fellow actors nominate you to the Academy, for, you know, from their branch. So it meant a tremendous amount to me, particularly, as I said, stepping out of the shadow of my father. And I know what it meant to Catherine, and, you know, what a, you know, bang-o performance that she did. I was just so well deserved. So that's the biggest part. Then the entire Academy then votes on all those five nominees in each division. So, you know, it's a tremendous honor. It really is, with all the hoopla that goes along with it. It's something that, you know, goes along in probably more than any other way of describing who you are, you know, two-time Oscar winner, or whatever it is. That's usually the first thing that's said, so it means a lot. In my father's case, it meant a tremendous amount because he had just had a stroke. Just before he got this special Oscar. And, you know, it's just the luck of the draw that somebody has done as great pictures as he had, who's been nominated three times, had never won. So I remember it as a wonderfully emotional night, in large part because he was able to stand up there. He was still alive, and he was the beginning of doing his rehabilitation of getting his speech back. On the Cuckoo's Nest Oscars, I said to Miloš, I said it's all downhill from here, Miloš. It's all downhill from here. You know, we won the five that night. I was 30 years old, so, you know, and then when Miloš won for Amadeus, Mikey D, it's not all downhill, huh, Mikey D. And so it's great. It's a nice honor. As far as having a relationship with an actress, and as far as each understanding the others work in business, you know, she's been working for a long time. You know, she was on the West End in Annie when she was 9, you know, starring in 42nd Street when she was 16, doing all those shows. So that's a tremendous discipline. She's also got a wonderful screen presence and idea of who she is. And I'm happy to see her in the last couple of films even stretch out more. I think she probably has the looks, but, you know, she also has a talent that didn't exist by a lot of the old-time Hollywood stars in terms of her singing and her dancing, which is the real thing. You know, acting is somewhat more interpretive. You can get away with it a little more. You can't hide too much behind singing and dancing. It appears generally that, you know, the rules are that as far as doing a romance together in a film for a married couple, audiences seem to lack the excitement, knowing somewhere in the back of their mind that these people are together, you know, all the time. But particularly now that Catherine and I have, you know, a couple of children, young children together, and given the times that it takes to make movies, you know, anywhere from, you know, 3 to 5 months that you could be away from home, we'd love to find a picture to do together. I think more like I'd be the villain, you know, I'd be the bad guy, and, you know, give her, because nobody likes these older guys with the younger women, so get her a young leading man, you know, and I'll be the bad guy and kind of off one of them, you know. I took the 3-year break largely because I was a new husband and a new father, which I never anticipated at this point in my life. And if you're gonna, you know, have children, you might as well really, really enjoy them. I mean, I have an older boy, and I missed a lot of his growing up when I was working so hard. And those early developmental years of a child, you know, when you have that unequivocal love of kids before your teen years and all of that, was a treat. Besides that, my wife is a very successful actress. She's in the prime of her career, and I knew Catherine would need some flexibility too, in terms of having some experience of how to try to maintain a marriage and make it, you know, work. So I try to make myself more flexible, and I just sort of, and I had it too. I was ready for kind of a break. I've always had a production company and have kept things going, and I know every time I say, oh, that's it, that, you know, 6 months from now I'm going to want to do something. And you're sort of responsible now more than ever for kind of initiating your own material. And I sort of work that way in fits and spurts. I'm looking forward to now focusing my efforts back with the United Nations, which I try to do a lot of work with in the area of disarmament, you know, small arms as well as weapons of mass destruction. Taking advantage of the fact as an actor that people know you all around the world. And, you know, a lot of times they'd rather talk to you than some other diplomat. So you have sort of an easier access with a lot of leaders in the world. And I enjoy kind of learning my lines and doing some work with that. So I think that'll be the big focus in the near time. Again, continually having deep respect for a family unit, knowing, you know, what that takes. I think it's just so tough for so many people earlier in their careers to start families and their careers at the same time. Something's got to give. And the movie business is not something that you can kind of keep in balance. It's about obsessions, you know. It's about being obsessive and passionate. So you got to make a choice sometimes.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, wow.
Wow. So Sharon Stone, then Michael Douglas, not so long after, huh?
Yeah,
yeah.
It's true, Steve. This does fall neatly in line with my current research into the erotic thriller genre post Alfred Hitchcock.
I wonder how we're going to talk about this phase in the talking show in the future. You know, where it'll be like there was an episode of the talking show that had someone else, and then there was an episode of the talking show about erotic thrillers. Remember that time?
Yeah. It is peculiar how many of those films feature Michael Douglas as the heroic male character.
Yeah, yet conflicted and horny. All those things at once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all that. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think is going on there? It's... He has an everyman quality, you know, like he's more handsome than your everyman, but he's not, you know, he's not Fabio, also a male sex icon of the time.
Yeah, no, he's not Fabio. It's true. He's a little slouchy, I guess. I don't know. I think the part that blew me away was I did not realize that he was in any way involved in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And that alone is like, that's something else, you know, like to be a behind the scenes guy on a thing like that. And then later on to sort of come into your own, really just playing the same guy over and over again, despite saying that you don't like doing the same guy over and over again. Or you're like, I want to make sure it's a good film and that good film be sexy.
Right.
Right? And suspenseful.
Yeah, you see him shirtless a lot in those films.
Uh-huh.
He has a kind of like nice, blocky dad body, right? It's broad. He's got like the, you know, the pecs aren't really chiseled, but they're there. Uh-huh. The abs aren't really chiseled, but they're there.
Okay.
No real excess fat.
Haven't really.
He's got some hefty nipples, if I remember correctly.
Haven't seen any of these.
Yeah,
lately.
What do you think's going on? Why was he the man to portray masculinity and the fate of female seduction in the 1990s?
I can't help you, dude. I mean, like, part of me is like, he did it because like another Baldwin couldn't or something, right? Like, that's why. Or like Gary Busey was too weird.
Yeah. Well, he's a curious character in many ways, one of which is that his father was a macho male actor.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, most people know that. So he inherited. This is his inheritance.
Right. His.
Yeah. And maybe that's why he's so fascinating. One of the reasons he's so fascinating for men to watch. Because, you know, we all inherit masculinity from our dads.
Oh, huh.
And movies and books and things, but primarily, fundamentally from our dads.
And like he has like, you know, he talks about just having like extreme dad issues, right?
Yeah.
So
I'm trying to think back. One of the ways my father expresses his masculinity is in being, having a very sharp logistical mind, you know,
uh-huh.
Waking up, thinking through the entire day, the entire week, the entire month, with great detail of how all the cogs will run together.
Uh-huh.
I'm not as good as him at it. Maybe that's always the,
that's what they say.
Role of the son is to be slightly worse.
Right.
But I take that from Norm.
Huh.
How about you, Steve? What do you take from old KG in terms of masculinity?
I'm not sure. Maybe just like taking long shits and reading the news. You know, that's like a key thing. Holding forth in conversation and then, I don't know.
Well, you know, no one ever said that this terroir didn't have a pungent stink.
Well, touché.
Mike sure had a lot to say, so I think we should let our listeners get some shut eye.
Yeah.
Before they tackle another wet and rainy Los Angeles day. Good morning, Chinatown.
Can't wait to hang out with Mike after the show.